Welcome into Scoops with DannyMac.com and the podcast featuring Tim McCarver. All podcasts are brought to you by Ryan Kelly. Visit him at thehomeloanexpert.com. Been really looking forward to putting this on the site. He's one of my best friends. That's Tim McCarver. Think about this for a moment. Tim McCarver played Major League Baseball in four different decades. Four. It started in 1959 as a 17-year-old and ended in 1980. Played for the Cardinals, Phillies, Expos, and Red Sox. He was the catcher for the great Cardinals teams. What a decade, the 1960s.
There's a drive, way back! It might be! It could be! It is! A home run! What did I say about one on the roof? McCarver just hit his ninth home run of the year. The Cardinals lead 2-0.
The 1960s, some of the greatest moments in Cardinals baseball history.
Three balls, two strikes. McCarver the batter. There's the stretch by Mickelson. Here's the pitch, there goes Grote. There's a drive, way back, it might be out of here. It could be, it is a home run. Tim McCarver being congratulated by everybody. A long drive into the lower section in right field. And the Cardinals have taken a 5-2 lead. McCarver's first World Series home run. And the Cardinals' third home run of the series.
An exciting brand of baseball.
All right, runners at first and third. One out, the Cards lead 1-0 in the bottom of the fourth. Runners lead away, the stretch. The pitch, the runner goes, the swing and the miss. The throw to second base will not be in time. The runner coming to the plate, the throw not in time. The double steal works. The Cardinals pull a double steal and score a run. And I want to tell you that was beautifully executed as McCarver got two-thirds of the way to second base and hesitated for a fraction of a second. At third base, Tim McCarver hesitated until Howard threw to second. Howard's throw was a little high towards the first base side of the bag, and Richardson could not get anything on the throw. The Cardinals pull a double steal and they lead 2-0. With Shannon at second and a count of one strike on Dal Maxwell. He swung at that pitch. The curve is low and away, and Shannon had a good jump that time. Looked like he might be going, Joe.
Tell you a fine piece of running because Howard had stopped McCarver at third base, and that's what you have to do. Is he stopped him dead, then threw to second, and it was not a real hard throw because he wanted to make sure McCarver stopped, but McCarver timed it perfectly and scored easily.
The pitch line to right field, a base hit. Mickey Mantle up with it. They're sending Shannon in to throw to the plate. Not in time, he scores, and Maxwell goes to second base. Holy cow, these Cardinals are red hot right now.
Once his outstanding playing career was over, it was off to the broadcast booth. He's worked for every major network, and his career has come full circle by rejoining the Cardinals. He's a member of baseball's Hall of Fame and the Cardinals Hall of Fame. We get into Bob Gibson, the 1960s, Red Schoendienst, his broadcasting career. It's all covered here. Hope you enjoy my conversation with Tim McCarver.
Hi, I'm Ryan Kelly with thehomeloanexpert.com. There's never been a better time to look at a refinance. Maybe it's time to get rid of the PMI or get some cash out to pay off the credit cards. 5 minutes could save you $500 a month. Thehomeloanexpert.com. Enjoy the podcast.
I've always wanted to ask you, well, there's a lot of things I'd like to ask you.
Most of them you've already asked me, so.
That is true.
This is like the second trial for
good point. In a general sense, you've made your living, your life out of baseball. Why do you love the sport so much? If you could take me back to when you were a kid or just getting to the Cardinals or the minor leagues, why do you love the game?
I don't think I realized initially how much I needed the game. I guess it's like a businessman needing a job and doing business and stuff like that. And originally, when I signed out of high school, I signed for a $75,000 bonus. That was more money than my father ever made during his life as a police officer, raising five children in Memphis. So I needed them. Originally, even though I was only 17 years old, I realized that signing a bonus contract with the Cardinals was the first step that I could take toward any kind of business that I wanted to do in my life and earn a living. And then I became hooked. And the game hooks you. And the love of the game came after taking care of myself from a financial standpoint.
Sure.
And even though I was very young, I mean, I was raw, man. And I mean really raw at 17. Just graduated from high school, signed with the Cardinals 9 days after that. And as a matter of fact, I was eligible for Legion ball later on that summer. I could have played American Legion ball.
They would have let you have gone back and done that.
Well, the Cardinals wouldn't have, but I was a professional
sure.
after that. But I could have actually, I was eligible to play
That's unbelievable.
On the American Legion team that September. And here, that September, I was with the Cardinals
exactly.
as a September call-up. So that, you know, things change in your life, and it certainly changed in my life. I mean, at 22, only 5 years later, 4 years later, I was in the World Series.
Right.
And we won it on the last day of the season. And that's when you win on that scale, you know, that's heady stuff. And it's heady, and it you have to keep your feet on the ground, and you have to level out. You can't live your life with that much exuberance for the rest of your life. But I was very emotional, always have been, and you're not going to change that. I mean, you know, that's in the pudding. But with that emotion became a desire to learn, and I wanted to learn a lot about the game. I wanted to learn how to hit, how to handle pitchers. I was very aware of all of those things, and that when you're a high school athlete, you have no idea. You have no concept of what it's like to play the game for a living, to play the game for everything. It's you're one of the best in the world at that, and to be playing the New York Yankees at Yankee Stadium, those three games, almost none of us had been there before, with the exception maybe of Dick Grote, who played with the Pirates in 1960. But again, that's heady stuff, and I was bound and determined to learn about my weaknesses and my strengths. And I was in a funk when I first signed with the Cardinals. I had an open stance, had no power, and it was George Crow in 1961. George, pardon me, Dan. George was released by the Cardinals, and in order to be paid for the rest of the year, the Cardinals asked if he'd go on a 2-week trip and help with some of their prospects, and I was one of those. And Hal Smith had a heart attack in 1961. I was sent back to play for Joe Schultz. I played for Joe 3 years in the minor leagues. But those sessions in Charleston, West Virginia, in the sweltering heat, in the afternoon where nobody was in the stands, and it was just George and me and a batting practice catcher and a batting practice pitcher, and I worked on what was to be a career in the making. What George did, I had an open stance and I choked up on the bat, so I hit only with my arms. What George did, he turned my shoulder and my front side into hitting against the front side. And had he not done that, I don't think I would ever have made it in the major leagues as a hitter. They were knocking the bat out of my hand. I got stronger, but it was the tips from George Crow that made me the hitter that I was to become. And then I worked from there.
Did you ever go back and tell him, thank you for what you did, and I attribute a lot of my success to you.
Are you kidding? Yes.
Yeah.
I have. I made that perfectly clear to a lot of people. People who care and the people who didn't care. As a matter of fact, when I was doing the Mets telecast in the 1980s, I made more than one comment about George Crow. And George at that time was almost a hermit living in Northern California. And he called me, and you talk about emotion. It was a very emotional conversation that I had with George. He said, I've heard some of the things that you've said, because WOR in New York was a superstation, so we went all throughout the California coast and Washington and all over the country. So it was kind of easy for him to know that I was saying right. Some of the things about him that I did, and obviously meant them so sincerely that if it weren't for him, he changed. It's like changing a golf swing, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But he changed my whole approach to hitting, and I became a hitter. I didn't have a lot of power, but I had enough power to make it. And the rest you just figure out on your own.
How about defensively? We've talked about it on the air, but who do you really credit for helping you get up to speed defensively?
A similar situation. That's a good question, because it's similar, because Hal Smith, when he had his heart attack in 1961, the Cardinals gave him the same option of going through the minor leagues and helping with their young catchers, prospects. And he came down, and it was kind of cool the way he did it. He gave me index cards, and all of it made so much sense. As an example, what do you call for on a 2-2 count? You don't want to go to 3-2. That's the one thing you want to stay away from. So you call for the pitch that the pitcher can get over. It might be a slider. It might be a breaking ball. He might be a breaking ball pitcher. Or it might be a fastball. If it is, call for that pitch. And these things made so much – they resonated with me. They made sense. And I told Hal, I think I was remiss in not giving Hal the credit that I gave George Crow. But Hal Smith was quite a mentor. He's a wonderful man to his dying day. He died a couple of years ago. But a fabulous catcher with a great throwing arm. And that's something that I didn't have. You know, you in baseball, you try to improve on some of your gifts. But you realize that, you know, I couldn't throw like Hal Smith. I couldn't throw like a lot of other catchers, John Roseboro, Tom Haller with San Francisco, or Johnny Edwards with Cincinnati. I was not getting, and believe me, I tried everything, strengthening, isometrics, that really almost before their time, to strengthen my arm. More than anything, though, I think the biggest problem I had throwing was making the transfer from the mitt to the hand. It's very, very important. And I used to hurry the transfer and not bring the left shoulder. I didn't realize – a lot of times catchers don't realize how quick their hands are. So they try to hurry the throw. And you see that if they do get a grip on the ball, that ring finger becomes involved.
Right.
And that's when you throw that little – tailing fastball into the runner to second base or to third or wherever you're trying to throw the ball. But I knew I had enough stuff to make. You know, the other stuff was good. I could run. I could hit with some power. Later on, I became a hitter that had more power in the late 60s and during the halcyon days of 64, 7, and 8. Those were years that they can never take away from you. And the camaraderie with what a group of people we had on that team. Very intelligent, smart, knew how to play the game, cared about each other. And that's a very, very important thing. There's a lot of leadership on that team from everybody unto themselves. A unique group of people. And of course, everybody thinks that that because they're on a championship team, that everybody is either a leader or a follower. That's sometimes not true, because I think with those teams during the 60s, we had leaders and followers, and guys were both leaders and followers. And it was a unique group of people, very intelligent group as a in mass. I mean, Curt Flood, you realize how bright he was, how smart, and his comments, his humor. And Bob Gibson and George Crow.
Mm-hmm.
George was a teacher, for crying out loud. And Bill White. I mean, Bill White becomes the president of the National League. You think about that group of people and what they did, it'll give you goosebumps.
Hi, I'm Ryan Kelly with thehomeloanexpert.com. There's never been a better time to look at a refinance. Maybe it's time to get rid of the PMI or get some cash out to pay off the credit cards. 5 minutes could save you $500 a month. Thehomeloanexpert.com. Enjoy the podcast.
I'm getting goosebumps thinking about it right now. And I came down here to do the interview, I started thinking about this. And I was thinking about this, too, with the 68 team when they were in town, 67 last year. You know, they talk about, like, the 27 Yankees being one of the all-time great teams, and this team and that team. Your team's in the 60s. When you start really breaking it down of the amount of people and the Hall of Famers that you had, it's truly one of the greatest teams ever that baseball has put together. And you could look at 64, 67, 68, any combination, when Cepeda gets there, when you get Roger Maris. I mean, think about the names that you guys had there.
Mm-hmm.
It truly is one of the great teams ever, and it should be in the probably top five, top ten of all time.
I think it's in the top five.
I really
do. Not from a power standpoint, but from an element. Everybody knew their roles and read Red knew that we knew. We knew how to play the game. We knew in mass how to play the game as a group. We knew individually what our jobs were. And we stuck to our jobs, and we tried to help each other. And baseball is such an individual game that, you know, that there can be a lot of uncaring. I've been on teams that didn't care a lot about the other guy. We cared about the other guy as much as we cared about themselves. I know that sounds kind of smaltzy, but it was a characteristic of that team. And it was almost to a man that they cared about the other guy.
Tim, as you grow up on the field, you also have to grow up, maybe more importantly, off the field to make sure you can stay on the field and
That's
be
true.
A pro.
That's true.
So who helped you off the field in all kinds of ways to help you grow up and take you out, have the fun times, but also understand, hey, it's a job, it's a business, this is your livelihood, so maybe this is a guy that's influenced your life away from baseball too.
Pee Wee Reese of the Dodgers was always, even 20 years after he finished playing, all the ex-Dodgers referred to him as captain. And that's an unusual thing in baseball, because being a captain is kind of it's a strange title in baseball. As a matter of fact, we were talking about it on our broadcast last night. But Kenny Boyer was an equal to Pee Wee Reese. I mean, everybody referred to Kenny as the captain.
The captain, yeah.
He was the captain. Went to his dying day, he was the captain. You know, again, that's an emotional thing to say, but he cared about the younger players. I remember in 1961, I came up for the third time because of Hal Smith's heart attack. And Kenny invited me out to his home after a Sunday day game. Well, his sister-in-law was in town, so he fixed me up with a date with his sister-in-law, who was at the time, I think, 16. I was 19. So, I mean,
unbelievable.
It was a bit. I mean, who would go to the trouble of fixing up a 19-year-old punk, you know, with his sister-in-law?
But it's great.
Yeah, it was. It was just wonderful. But that's who he was. That's how much he cared. And Dick Groat taught me more about base running than anybody. I never dreamed that there was that much to know about base running, running through the bag as an example, not to the bag. If you hit a ball hard with a man on first base and less than two outs, don't give a pull-out or a pull-up attempt at first base. In other words, don't you see it happen all the time now. But guys pull up, anticipating an out as opposed to running through the bag. And the present-day Cardinals, Harrison Bader, you can see when he hits a ball relatively hard with a man on first and less than two outs, he runs through the bag. That's a great trait.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not even sure he realizes that he does it because he's always been doing it.
Right.
But I needed that awareness. I needed that constant. And Dick Groat was tough on me. He was tough. I remember once I went 3-for-4 and we lost the game. And, you know, there's sometimes when you play a game, if you do well and the team loses.
It's an individual sport, like you said.
It's an individual sport. And I was walking around the clubhouse like I didn't have a care in the world. And Dick Groat said, you know what you're acting like today? You're acting like a guy who went 3-for-4 in a losing effort. And that got my attention.
I bet it did.
It got my attention. And he said it in front of some of the guys. And when somebody cares that much to tell you, and I realized that. I mean, I was not dumb. I was, you know, he was saying it to help me and not to hurt me. But he would make comments like that. And the game was different in those days. There were more guys that cared about the other guy.
Accountability to...
Yeah, there's so much money in the game today.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, our minimum salary was $6,000 for 22 years from 1945 to 1967. $6,000 a year.
Right.
So we weren't in it necessarily for the money. I talked about the money earlier because of a bonus, and I was very happy for that because Bob Gibson got $4,000 in Omaha. As an example.
Do you remind him of that you got a higher bonus than he did?
No, you know, I've never talked to him about that, but Bob's never forgotten the fact that he got $4,000.
I was going to ask you about Bob, and so much has been said about 1.12. What do you take away from that now 50 years later? That's number one. And number two, was there at any point in the season did you realize as a young man and you're catching this guy and he's in an elite level – and you're saying there is something special going on right now. So back then, did you know something was special? And now 50 years later, you reflect on it, what stands out?
When I met Bob earlier, you mean?
No, in 68 for 1.12.
Well, you'd have to be a rock on Mars not to realize that Bob Gibson was having one of those unbelievable seasons that you can truly say that he's the only one who's had that type of season in the history of the game.
Ever matched again?
I don't think so. No, the way the game is structured now, I don't believe that anybody will give up 1.12 earned runs per nine innings.
It's unbelievable.
But while you're going through it, there's a rhythm that from a catcher and a pitcher standpoint, and that can't be emphasized enough because you can't explain the rhythm that's going on. Bob is such an elegant performer. He was tough. But that elegance and that flow, the rhythm that he had he would love to work very, very quickly. And it was your job that, as Bob told me and he told anybody who caught him, that the first thing you think of, put it down. And if I don't want to throw it, I won't throw it. But he had two pitches that acted like 10. You know, even when they backed up, even when his slider backed up, it backed up differently than other pitchers' backup pitches. When he hung a slider, it was not the same as other guys who hung pitches. It was tougher to hit. It was tougher to catch. I knew what was coming, and there was such late break with both his slider and his fastball, and his control was really underrated. He started in 1966. He was much better throwing the ball where he wanted to right-handed batters on the outside part of the plate. And then he got closer to perfection in 67. And then he broke his ankle. You know, I've always said that Nelson Briles helped Bob Gibson be a better pitcher, because when Nelson came back, when Bob broke his ankle in 1967, Nelson Briles stepped into that role, and what a remarkable job he did. 14-2 and an earned run average of about 240 or something like that. And Bob pitched the clincher in Philadelphia, and there was no way he was going to lose to anybody. It just so happened to be the Red Sox in the Fall Classic, which was really a classic kind of outcoming. Bob Gibson was great in 64, but he really showed the nation just how powerful and how much of a presence he was to have.
Yes.
And he did the same thing against Detroit in game one when he struck out 17 in 68. And then ultimately we lost that series as Detroit came back and won three in a row. And it still bites. It still hurts. It's still one of the things in your life that, hey, it's over and it's not going to happen again. But and they're to be given credit, and you tip your cap. As a matter of fact, we play in Detroit this year, and in going over my schedule, the Cardinals asked if I would, and Fox Sports Midwest asked if I would try to put the Detroit series on our schedule, and I said, of course. I mean, you can't do anything about it now, but gosh, it still hurts.
I bet.
And our reliance on Gibson for Game 7 was a key item, and I think that, you know, it's hard to say that that's what led to the demise and what allowed Detroit to come back and win three games in a row. Of course, game five in Detroit, Mickey Lolich hitting for himself, two runs down in the seventh inning with one out and nobody on. It was still tough to take. But our reliance on Gibson, I think, a little bit was one of the reasons that we didn't we knew Gibson we knew they weren't going to score off Gibson. He was infallible. I mean, he'd been that way through 34 starts during the season. He had two during the World Series. This was his 37th start. We knew that, hey, it's Bob Gibson, and we end up losing and because we couldn't hit Lolich. And Roger Maris had told us in August, forget about McLean. McLean's going to win. Denny McLean
31 wins that year, yeah.
Won 31, and he said,
don't worry
about
him.
Not even close. Lolich is a guy. Lolich is a guy you got to watch.
Amazing.
Those words are still ringing in my ear, and sure enough, Roger was right.
You said that you know, you were such a young man when you signed, 17 years old.
Right.
Growing up in Memphis at a time that there's racial tension.
Oh, man.
And now you look back at your life, and one of your best friends is an African-American that you went through so much with in baseball, in life, with Bob Gibson. It's pretty amazing, isn't it?
9 years after I graduated, Robert Kennedy was killed. Jack Kennedy, of course, assassinated in Dallas in 1963. And then Martin Luther King was killed the same year that Robert Kennedy. And I remember Bob and I had a private conversation, just the two of us in the clubhouse. And we were wondering, you know, some of the players wanted to not play during those times. And then, of course, Martin Luther King was killed during spring training. And Roger Maris, we were going out to eat. There were about four or five of us going out to eat together, and Roger had just heard it on the news that Martin Luther King was killed in Memphis. And about 2 days later, Bob and I talked, just the two of us. And I'll never forget that conversation. And he made one comment that I said, you know, Bob, I was a Catholic growing up in a Protestant state. Only Tennessee was 6% Catholic. And I faced prejudice also. And he said, yeah, but you were white. And he was right. And that comment has never left me. And that opened my eyes to the plight of the African-American, not only athlete, but the African-American period. It was one of the warmest conversations I've ever had with anybody about any subject.
Amazing. By the way, I said 20 minutes. Now we're going too long. So that's, you're okay with this, right?
Of course.
Hi, I'm Ryan Kelly with thehomeloanexpert.com. There's never been a better time to look at a refinance. Maybe it's time to get rid of the PMI or get some cash out to pay off the credit cards. 5 minutes could save you $500 a month. Thehomeloanexpert.com. Enjoy the podcast.
I tell people all the time, if you want to learn how to be a broadcaster, if you're an analyst or play-by-play guy, you listen to Tim McCarver. And I mean this sincerely, the best that's ever done it in baseball. I think there's John Madden in football. I think there's Tim McCarver in baseball. So we talked about your influences in playing, and I could have gone on and on and on about playing, but I'd only have limited time with you, Tim, because you're a very busy man, and your agent only told me I have a few minutes. So, so broadcasting, number one, how did it start? Two, your influences in broadcasting.
I don't think I really had any influences in broadcasting.
So how did you figure it out, how to do it?
I was thrown into the wolf's den and figured it out for myself. I didn't go to school. I've never learned how to enunciate like you can, or like a lot of good, really good broadcasters. The one thing that I learned at a very young age is you've got to be yourself. You've got to, it's you who's doing the talking. It's you who's trying to figure it out. It's you that's got to explain it. It's you that's got to clip it and make sure you don't talk too much. And I was really guilty of that when I was younger. I started in 1980, and it actually began 5 years earlier. When the Blue Jays came into being in 1977, along with Seattle, Peter Bavese was the general manager of Toronto. And I knew the Bavese family very well because I'd competed against the Dodgers the Koufax and years, Drysdale and against Gibson, and Gibson and Koufax, when they went together, I mean, it was really a spectacle. It was really something to look forward to. And I became close friends with Peter Bavese and his father, Walter. I knew Peter a lot better than Walter because of the generation gap. But anyway, he asked if the Blue Jays, he asked the Phillies at the time, and the Carlton thing had started, and I'd caught 1 year with Lefty, just catching him primarily. And he was successful that year in 1976. So after the season, we won the division. It was the first of three straight divisions that we won in Philadelphia. And Peter Bavese asked if he could talk to me, and Bill Giles said, who was a business manager at the time, said, well, you can talk to him. What are you going to talk to him about? You know, one of those things.
That's great.
Peter said, I would like to offer him a contract to do a 4-year deal to work with Tom Cheek, of the newly established Blue Jays in Toronto. And the deal was a good deal for me. I mean, I had to think about my family and all that sort of stuff.
Sure.
And the money on the table. And Bill Giles said, well, here's what we'll do. We'll give you what you want as a player, 1-year deal, and we'll give you a 2-year deal to do cable with Chris Wheeler in Philadelphia. And I said, I like that. So that gave me the impetus to move my family from Memphis to Philadelphia. And so I ended up playing three more years. I signed my last contract as a player was a two-year deal. The only time I had a two-year deal.
Is that right?
Yeah. Never had an agent.
You spanned four decades, and you never had a multi-year deal.
Until the last 2 years, 1978 and 9. Yeah. Well, there were no agents in those days, very few. But when free agency came along, well, the agencies came along, came alive.
Because with it,
there was more than the 10% to make in those days. So anyway, when I started with the Phillies, I was the fifth man in a four-man booth. I was really the odd man out all the time. I mean, I did one inning a game with Richie Ashburn. He did the play-by-play. He ate peanuts while he was doing the play-by-play. It was hilarious. There's a ground ball to short, crunch, crunch, crunch. He would swallow and then one out.
I love it.
Yeah, and that's a true story. And Whitey kept asking. The producer was Gene Kirby, who's a longtime producer, and it did the game of the week back with Pee Wee Reese and Dizzy Dean. And Ashburn would say, "I don't understand why McCarver and I are limited to just one inning a game." And Gene said, "Richie, it's because you're not as good as Harry Callis. It's that simple." And Richie said, "You know, you have a point." I said, "I've never looked at it like that."
That's awesome.
It was great. I mean, it was fun. It was funny. Ashburn, what a character. And Harry Callis was among the best with
ever,
with those pipes of his. So anyway, those 3 years in Philadelphia, I observed more than anything. After 2 years with the Phillies, the assistant general manager of the Mets called me, and his mother and father-in-law lived in Wildwood, New Jersey. His name was Al Harrison, and he used to be down there, and you know, cable didn't exist every place. We did 30 cable games on Prism. That's with an M, not an N.
Yeah, let's clarify that.
Yeah, right. And so I did those 30 games. I did the complete games with Chris Wheeler doing the play-by-play. And I would do two innings of play-by-play per game. So I got my feet wet doing that. Well, anyway, the Mets called, Al Harrison called, and I said, "No, I've got my family here. I'm happy in Philadelphia and the whole bit. Doing okay as far as salary and everything." Well, he called again after that season in 82. And Bill Giles had made it clear that nobody's leaving Philadelphia, and you're still going to be, you know, kind of the fifth guy in a four-man booth. And so I took the job in New York, and it was tough from a familial standpoint. You know, we'd been settled in our home in Philadelphia and all that. My children were going to school in Philadelphia, but anyway, this was my shot. If I was ever going to have a shot, this was my shot at the big time, because everybody knew that New York was the mecca of broadcasting, mecca of a lot of things. But broadcasting was certainly one of them, with all the networks up there. And if you had any idea about network television, then you ought to jump at it. And I did, eventually. First, I turned them down originally, but then I thought, it just makes too much sense to go up there. So I signed a two-year deal with the Mets, and I became – that was 2 years. The first two were the first two of 16 years I worked with Ralph Kiner, and it clicked. And the Mets were good, and Doc Gooden was coming along, and Daryl Strawberry. And Davey Johnson was the manager, beautifully arrogant, and the Mets owned that town. I mean, own New York. The Yankees were not an item in those 80s.
Yeah.
And the Cardinals remember very well.
Oh, yeah.
As a matter of fact, the lore of the rivalry with the Mets and the Cardinals. But anyway, and the networks came calling and the whole bit, and I signed with, I ended up working with all four networks eventually. I worked with ABC initially and with Al Michaels and Jim Palmer. And then from 90 through 93, I worked with Jack Buck and Sean McDonough on the CBS package, and then moved to Fox with Joe Buck in 1996, and then retired in 2013.
Does it feel like you've come full circle when you reflect now on your life and your professional life, to think that here's this young man that comes out of Memphis High School, you grew up cheering for the Cardinals.
Yep,
and
right.
Here you are playing for the Cardinals in one of the greatest, if not the greatest, decade of baseball in St. Louis. And now you're back broadcasting for the Cardinals. Does it feel like, you know what, this was right? I came back and it's full circle.
It's full circle, Danny. And and it does make sense. It makes sense the way I've led my life to me. And you're always responsible to yourself the way you live your life. Yeah, I'm very happy with the way things have turned out coming back to the Cardinals. And John Mozeliak was the first one who mentioned it to me before Game 6 in the 2013 World Series. He said, what are you going to do, just sit at home? And I said, no. And he said, well, you know, we should talk. And we did. And something came of that, and that's why I've been announcing with you over the last 6 years.
It's been so much fun.
And it has.
And
it
my
really
final
has.
My final question for you, Tim, what are you most proud of as you look back in your life as a father, as a friend? I consider you one of my closest friends in life.
Me too.
And baseball, broadcasting, what are you most proud of as you look back?
Well, you know, my life, like any baseball player, who's, you got to take life in segments. Life changes so much. I mean, I was a baseball player, and in many ways, nothing can ever beat that. Nothing can beat the smell of the dugout or the smell of the dressing room or pine tar or rosin. You never are involved with these elements of your life. Nor should you be, but you are as a player. It's dirt. It's grind. It smells right, and nothing in many ways can ever compare to playing. The locker room, the camaraderie, winning, losing. Chuck Tanner used to say, "The next best thing to winning a major league game is losing a major league game."
Well put.
Because you've had the opportunity to do that, and then you become more of somebody who's going to either intentionally or otherwise give your opinions about the game of what you've learned. Some people agree with those opinions. Some people don't. It's part of the game. It's part of the way, you know, some of the things that you say on the air rankles some players, rankles some managers. Not intentionally. I don't intentionally do that. But you realize that if you're going to tell the truth as you know it, that it's got to be honest. It's got to be forthright. Say what comes to your mind. And I've learned that it's very important to be, you know, if honesty is your trademark, be honest and say it, and say it with conviction, and say it like you mean it, because I do mean it. I don't want to step on toes, but I have stepped on toes. I never intentionally did that. It's a fascinating life. So therefore, you know, you got the smell of the dugout as a player, you've got the forthrightness as an adult, and you have to answer to what you say and be responsible for that, and you have to do that. I mean, you have to stand up. You have to come back in the clubhouse the next day and be accountable for some of the things that you say on the air. I've learned to do that. I've been dressed down by players, by managers over, 37 years of broadcasting. And nobody who takes that stance, to me, it's a responsible stance to take, that you're as honest as you can be on the air, or honest as you know it. Doesn't mean you're always right. Doesn't mean you're right any percent of the time or anything like that. It's just an opinion. It's just an opinion. And you learn to live that. If I had it all to do over again, Danny, I'd do it exactly the same way. Exactly. I wouldn't change a thing about the way I do a baseball game.
Love it. That's the way to do it. As I wrap it up with this, people say to me, what's it like working with Tim McCarver? I said, it's been the most exhilarating experience of my professional career. I said, it's been a blessing. I'm so lucky to learn from Tim, to be around Tim. And I said, the thing I'm most proud of, and I get goosebumps thinking about this, is that when we talk on the phone, we always end by saying, I love you, man. And I do. I love you.
I feel the same way, Danny.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Ryan Kelly with thehomeloanexpert.com. There's never been a better time to look at a refinance. Maybe it's time to get rid of the PMI or get some cash out to pay off the credit cards. 5 minutes could save you $500 a month. Thehomeloanexpert.com.
He's an amazing man, one of my best friends and my television partner, and that is Tim McCarver. Remember, on the website, scoopswithdannymac.com, we have Mondays with Mo, our weekly visit with John Mozeliak, game previews before any game on Fox Sports Midwest. We have podcasts that drop every week. And as always, we also have the Minor League Report every Tuesday and Monday. Thanks for checking out Scoops with DannyMac.com.